share with you now the formal biography of Rabbi Dr. Jason Weiner, but I do want to let you know that while he and I have not had lots of interactions together, the few times that we have met in the hallways of Cedar Sinai, it's always been by Rabbi Weiner, a pause, as busy as he is, to stop and ask me how I am doing, why I am here, who I am visiting, how Cedar Sinai and he can be of help. And I've seen him when he hasn't seen me in the hallways of Cedar Sinai. And I don't know how he gets through his day, because somebody is always stopping him and he's always taking as much time is necessary for that person to feel that they are heard, that they are seen, and that they are understood. I want to thank him for being here this afternoon, especially given that it was very last minute, because as many of you know, it was going to be Rabbi Bradley Artson who was going to be kicking off our lecture series, but he had surgery on Friday, and thank God he is doing well, and we offer our prayers of refuah shleima to him. And at the very last minute, I called Rabbi Weiner, and he said, of course, I would be happy to. So thank you. He serves as the senior rabbi and director of the spiritual care department at Cedar Sinai in Los Angeles, where he is responsible for the chaplaincy team and all aspects of spiritual care throughout the health system. And many of the students that I have had the pleasure of speaking with and teaching over the years who have studied with him have all said such wonderful things about his kindness and his incredible mentorship. He previously served as the assistant rabbi at Young Israel of Century City. He's earned two rabbinic ordinations. One wasn't enough. As well as a doctorate in clinical bioethics from Loyola University of Chicago. We also earned a master's degree in bioethics and health policy, in addition to a master's degree in Jewish history, Yeshiva University. You should push yourself a little bit. He's completed 4 units of clinical pastoral education. He's a board-certified chaplain through Neshama, the Association of Jewish Chaplains. He's also a member of the Executive Committee of Cedar Sinai Bioethics Committee, the past president of the Southern California Board of Rabbis, and has been honored with the Rabbinic Leadership Awards from the Orthodox Union and High Lifeline. It goes on and on and on, but you're not here to hear about his biography. You're here to hear his wisdom. And so if you have a cell phone, just turn it off right now or put it to silent so it doesn't interrupt. And it is indeed a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Dr. Jason Weiner to our community. There are books for sale at a discounted price afterwards for $20. If you would like to take a book, just stick the money in an envelope in the back and you can take a book and enjoy it. Rabbi Weiner.
Well, thank you, Rabbi Kamris. I mean, you're very kind in that introduction, and it gives me a lot to live up to, I think. And Rabbi Kamris was modest in his words. You know, I get to see and interact with many patients' rabbis. And most rabbis, understandably, you know, Los Angeles is a big city, and there's lots of traffic. Most rabbis can't make it to the hospital, but they'll call, or they'll be there for their congregants in ways that they can. One of the rabbis that I see most frequently at the hospital visiting patients is Rabbi Kamris. And it's not close to Cedar Sinai, and there's lots of traffic, and he does, you know, it's obviously not always possible, but when he can, he's there. And I've been so impressed by the way that he shows up whenever he can. It's just his kindness and his sensitivity. He's very kind to praise me, but I learned it from people like Rabbi Kamris. You're very lucky to have such a rabbi like him. And it's really an honor to be here for this program. I'm like choked up already from this introduction. Lazer Cohen, a blessed memory, the things I heard about him, you know, the way that science and God come together, and the way he dedicated his life to the Jewish community, to social justice, to the love of learning Torah. Just someone with such an honor to learn about him and to say some words, hopefully in his honor, that hopefully he would have been engaged by these words, and that really gave me the motivation. Rabbi Artson is someone who I look up to incredibly, and so hopefully I can just do a fraction of what Rabbi Artson would have done for his memory. So it's really an honor to be here to encourage that his memory should be for a blessing always. So what I wanted to share were just some kind of highlights of the most recent, the most cutting-edge questions in Jewish law as they relate to medical technology as it's advancing in recent years. And I'll just take the last 2 years. Let's just say the last 2 years of medical advances. And you know, there's lots of questions that rabbis get asked in hospitals. In fact, I remember one of the first questions that I was asked. You see, Cedar Sinai, if any of you have ever been there, right between the main hospital and the Beverly Center, there used to be, actually, if any of you remember way back, there were pony rides. And then there was, you do remember, and then there was a supermarket there. And then there was just a parking lot. And today there is a big building called the Advanced Health Sciences Pavilion, a big 9-story modern building. And when that building, when the foundation was laid for that building, I was new at the hospital, and they asked me to be there for the coin toss ceremony. They said, Rabbi, I was new. I wanted to impress them. I thought they hired me because maybe they thought I was smart or something. And they said, Rabbi, of course you'll be there to lead the coin toss ceremony, right? So I said, oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, of course I'll be there. I started calling different rabbis so I know, what is a coin toss ceremony? And they all said, are you sure they asked for a coin toss ceremony? I said, yeah, I was good. I asked them twice. They said, there's no such thing. I Googled it. But the chair of the board said to me, Rabbi, you're going to lead it, right? I didn't want to look foolish, so I just said, yes, no, of course. So I didn't know what I was going to do. What is a coin toss ceremony? The night before the coin toss ceremony, I had to get a call from a senior vice president of the hospital. Rabbi, I'm heading to the bank. The ceremony is tomorrow morning. Which coins do you need for the coin toss ceremony? And I still, at that point, didn't know, what am I going to do? What is a coin toss ceremony? So I had to think on the spot. I thought, well, I said to him, you know, if we throw in pennies, that, you know, that looks cheap. And if we throw in silver dollars, that's a waste of money. So, of course, dimes. Get dimes. And he said, oh, brilliant, Rabbi. Yes, thank you. That's what we'll do. I just made it up on the spot. But these are the questions that I was being asked at first. So we just threw in the coins. I don't know. I said a prayer, and we threw in 18 coins. And they told me that this is going to mean the building will last, you know, have chaim life for 18. I don't know who made up the ceremony. Actually, since then, Cedar Sinai Marina Del Rey is opening a new building soon. And I got an email just this past week. Rabbi, we heard you know how to lead the coin toss ceremony, so please guide us in what that means. This is how traditions start, right? And now all of a sudden I'm the expert in coin toss ceremonies. And when the building was finished, this you might have heard of. This I Googled and it is true. They said, Rabbi, we need you there for the topping off ceremony. The topping off ceremony apparently is that when a high-rise building is built, an evergreen tree is placed on the last steel beam, and all the construction workers and the leadership of the organization sign the beam. And then they hoist the beam into place, and the evergreen tree symbolizes, you know, everlasting life or something. The building should last forever. And they said to me, we have an urgent question. We have a big problem, Rabbi. You see, we have the topping off ceremony planned, but someone in our leadership decided, you know, we are Cedar Sinai. Why are we using an evergreen tree? We should use a cedars tree. But they said, you know, before we break with, you know, ancient tradition, we have to ask the rabbi, is it permissible to use a cedar tree at the topping off ceremony? And I saw they took this question very seriously. So I said, I got to make them feel like it's a serious question. So I said, no, I have to look that up. That's a hard question. So I'm going to look into it. I have to consult the holy books and I'll get back to you. You know, it might take me a few hours. So of course, you know, I had lunch and took my time. And then I called them back and I said, apparently, you know, I looked into this. Apparently you're in luck. As it turns out, at UCLA, it would not be allowed. But at Cedar Sinai, since we have cedars in our name, there is permission. You may use the cedar tree. So they said, thank you, Rabbi. Oh, what would we do without you? I don't know, because I made it all up. But but these are some of the questions that I've been asked over the years that you really don't need even one rabbinic ordination for, not to mention two rabbinic ordinations, because I literally made those questions up. I mean, those answers up on the spot. Of course, those are some questions rabbis are asked in hospitals, and I'm sure Rabbi Karmus has examples of that rabbis are asked in synagogues as well. And those are sometimes, you know, fun and interesting questions, but there's also, of course, very serious questions and very challenging questions. And that's what I want to share with you, some of the most recent challenging questions that there aren't even necessarily answers for yet, but I want to suggest some answers. So let's say within 2 years, just the last 2 years, the most cutting-edge questions. Some of them have made the news, some of them have not yet. So what's an example of one that made the news in the last couple of years? Yeah, that's true, and I'm not going to talk about it so much, but I'll mention it a little bit. But one that did make the news a little bit during the pandemic was the first heart transplant from a pig. A pig's heart to a human being. And I started getting emails, Rabbi, this is amazing, right? Could save so many lives. May a Jew accept a heart from a pig's heart? That's an interesting question. Is it a hard question? Is this as hard as the, you know, topping off ceremony? Some say yes, some say no. Well, the truth is, to be honest, I mean, you, as long as you don't eat the heart, right? We can get a pig's, you know, we use heart valves from pigs all the time. And in Jewish law, you can get benefit from a pig. You just can't eat the pig. So as long as you don't eat it, someone asked me, and I was talking about this, said, well, what if you would take a cow, and the cow needed a heart transplant, and the cow got a pig's heart, and then, you know, they chef the cow, can you eat that steak? Okay, it would be trafe anyways, because if it had an operation, but interesting question, but a human can receive. First of all, it would be saving a life, pikuach nefesh. To save a life, you can do anything, but the truth is, you can receive it. If it came to it, that person who got the pig heart transplant only survived a couple of months, and then he died. So it's not really ready yet for humans, but if a human needs a heart transplant from a pig, they may receive it. But what's interesting, and this leads to some other issues that haven't been in the news so much, but they're coming and they're developing, is how did they get a pig heart into a human? I mean, it's not so supposed to be compatible. How can you? It is true that pigs are very similar genetically to humans, but they're not the same. How can you get a pig's heart in a human? So there is turns out there's a farm in Pennsylvania where they are genetically modifying pigs to have human qualities, and these pigs are growing up with human hearts. Or human-like hearts. They're in pigs, but they're compatible with human beings, and the hope was that they could then transplant them, and they're getting there, and they're not quite there yet. But how did they genetically modify these pigs' hearts to fit into a human? So there is technology known as, and this is not exactly what they use, but it's the same type of technology called CRISPR, gene editing technology. And this starts to get to some really cutting edge and very relevant, as I'll show you, things that we will be talking about literally in our doctor's offices in the next 5 to 10 years. I mean, there already are a little bit now, but really every day. CRISPR is gene editing, where we can actually take someone's genes and edit, take out the parts of the genes that are causing illnesses if they are genetic diseases. This is a very complicated and controversial area of medicine because we don't really know yet the impacts of this. I mean, we can theorize. We now see in what ways our genes impact our lives, right? We have a much better idea than we ever did before about genetics and how our genes impact as we age and all the ways that our abilities, our looks, our illnesses are oftentimes based on our genes. So if we can just play with the genes and edit out those genes that cause things that we don't want them to cause, or edit in the things that we do want, we could really transform humanity. And in the past 2 years, you might have heard, the first CRISPR baby was born in China. They actually edited a baby's genes. They just wanted to be very minimal. So they edited this baby, this human being, to be immune to AIDS. I don't know. I'm not sure why they chose that, but because they wanted to just try to edit his genes slightly to see what would happen. And so far he's healthy, but we don't know what's going to happen long term. I mean, with everything in life, there's something that we call in medicine off-target effects. Off-target effects are when you make a change when you have a target with something you want to change, and you know what it will do, and it does that, it has that impact, but then you don't know in what ways will it have other impacts. And the truth is, Jews have been discussing this for thousands of years. I'll give you some examples of what I mean. Who here thinks it would be just great to have a perfect memory? Wouldn't it be nice? I mean, school, I really struggled in school on tests and memorizing things for tests. And people all the time come to me, oh, Rabbi, remember when you visited me in the hospital? Remember what we talked about? Remember that thing? You know, remember my anniversary? I don't remember these things. I have a horrible memory. It would be great to just edit our genes and have a perfect memory. Wouldn't it be wonderful? Yeah. Well, Rav Sadia Gaon, 1,000 years ago, writes, God did us the greatest favor by giving us forgetfulness. Why? Why? He says, imagine every horrible thing that we've ever experienced, every broken heart, every tragedy. I mean, we're talking about 9/11. We're talking about losses. Imagine if that was on the forefront of our minds at all times. not just some there, somewhat there, but we would be experiencing that trauma every second. So he says, you know, we have the challenge. Part of being human is we forget things. We want to try to remember the things that we need to remember. We want to try to remember even the sad things, but in a way that we can function. But to never be able to forget would be very, very difficult. The Talmud says, in the times of the Talmud, the people, and in the truth in the times of the Bible, the people, the Jews, had a very strong urge to worship idols. We can't really relate today so much, at least not to idols the way they refer to idols. Like, they couldn't help themselves. They loved praying to these idols. And the rabbis felt, you know, this is going too far. We're supposed to be worshiping God only. So they actually prayed to remove the desire to worship idols from the human soul. And they succeeded. And we no longer had the desire to worship idols. And at that moment, prophecy ceased. They didn't realize the part of our souls that had that ability to achieve prophecy, obviously just for some people, was connected to that alternate side, which had the desire to worship idols. So there's a lot of risks. There's a lot of risks associated with editing our genes, and it's coming, but there's concerns. So why do I bring this up? Why do I bring this up, and why, you know, what does Judaism have to say about it? Because that's for me is the first question. Can our tradition, our tradition was founded mostly thousands of years ago. Obviously, we build on every generation, but our foundational texts are thousands of years old. Could they have imagined these abilities? Well, maybe they could have in some ways, as I've shared some examples. There is a fascinating story in the Bible. The Bible tells of Chizkiyahu HaMelech, one of the last of the kings of the first temple, as, you know, this is now going back 2,500 years, 2,600 years. Chizkiyahu was a good king. He tried to do good things. He tried to stop people from worshiping idols. He tried to help people. He tried to, you know, bring peace to the region. He was very, very good. And he refused to have children. He refused. Why did he refuse to have children? Because he had a prophecy that his son would be an evil king. It's like we're talking about the monarchy, you know, now, this transition of power. He knew that his, and I'm not implying anything about King Charles, I'm not saying that in any way, I'm just saying the whole transition of power is what I'm saying. The idea of transition of power, that Chizkiyahu knew that his son would be an evil king, so he said, I'm not having children. And Isaiah, the prophet, came to him and said, God is going to punish you. Because, and this is the line in Hebrew, Hanikavshi derachmana lamalach. It's not your place to play God. That's the line. People sometimes ask me, Rabbi, is there such thing in Judaism as not playing God? Well, on the one hand, we do believe in playing God. You know, there's a great story about Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, the great rabbi of the Talmud, the story goes that someone, a Roman emperor, came to him and said to him, Rabbi, I see you Jews are trying to heal the sick. You're trying to help people when they're sick. You have very little faith. You're heretical. He said, what do you mean we're heretical? And he said, the Roman said to him, Rabbi Akiva, God makes people sick. Who are you to try to heal them? And Rabbi Akiva said to him, what do you do for a living? He said, I'm a tiller of the soil. I'm a farmer. He said, that's interesting. Tell me about your profession. He says, well, I wait for the right season. I plant my seeds. I then, you know, perfect my crop. I then, you know, harvest my crop, and I prepare it, and then I have it sent to the markets to be sold. And it's a process that really takes expertise. He said, well, I don't understand. Why don't you just bring the wheat to the market? Why don't you just bring the weeds that grow in the fields? He says, Rabbi Kiv, you don't understand. You know, the wheat grows, but you have to learn how to develop it and develop the crops. It's part of being human, is develop. He says, oh, interesting. You just told me I'm heretical for healing the sick. Sounds to me like you're heretical for trying to perfect the fields. Another Roman came to Rabbi Akiva and said, Rabbi Akiva, why do you help the poor? Why do you help them? God made them poor. Just let them be poor. So Rabbi Akiva said to him, no, that's part of our tradition, is we help the people in need. So he said. So the Roman says to him, you know what? You Jews are bad. He says, imagine a king took somebody and sent them to prison. And then you went and freed them from prison. Wouldn't the king be mad at you? And it says in your Torah that you are slaves. You're servants of God. And you're the servants of God. God puts, you know, puts people in prison, and you servants go and release them from prison. You're heretical. So Rabbi Akiva said, let me just change your example a little bit. Imagine a parent gets really upset at their child. And in their anger, they banish them. They kick them out of their house and put them in some kind of a cell, in some kind of a prison. But then someone comes and frees them and helps them reconcile with their parents. Would that not be a good thing? And it says in the Bible, yeah, it says we're servants of God, but it also says we're children of God. And so we do everything we can to make the world a better place. So on the one hand, God wants us to play God, so to speak. We're supposed to, we believe in Judaism and surgeries and medicine and helping make the world a better place. But somewhere there's a line. Somewhere there's a line that Isaiah was critiquing Chizkiyahu and saying, Hanikavshi derachmana lamalach. A certain point, it's not your place. It's not your place, humans, to go too far. So Chizkiyahu in the end, he said to Isaiah, fine, let me marry your daughter if you think that everything's going to be okay. And he did. Isaiah let him marry his daughter. They had a child. His name was Menashe. He ended up being one of the worst kings in Jewish history. But that's the story. So what can we say? So that's part of it. Now, does this give us precedent to answer this question about CRISPR? What will Judaism, what will the rabbis say about CRISPR? Can we edit our genes? Can we say, you know, in my family, we can know so many things are genetic, whether it's heart disease or Alzheimer's. There's so many things that can be genetically, passed down. Might we want to influence them with genetic engineering? So there was another case that came up where the rabbis gave us a certain guidance. And this might be able to be useful for CRISPR. And it'll allow me to share with you one more new innovation that came out in the last couple of years that is just mind-boggling. And it'll let me give the whole summary of my presentation, which is there's something called PGD. PGD stands for pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. Here's how it works, and here's why it's relevant. PGD is IVF. Someone uses IVF. Once they have a sperm and an egg in the lab, I sometimes think of this, you know, like Uber. Why is it like Uber? It was only a matter of time once we all had, you know, iPhones or, you know, smartphones that we started giving each other rides, right? Once you're connected with everyone, there's things that start, you know, developing in technology. So too, once we started to have the ability to create babies in a lab, right, to help people through IVF, clinicians, scientists started to realize there's things we could do. There's other things we could do. So what's PGD? PGD is, let's say there is a couple who know that they are carriers for a certain genetic illness, genetic mutation, and they don't want to have children with that mutation. So they can get pregnant through PGD, and in the lab, they can now have 4 or 5 pre-embryos. And the researchers will then test each of them and determine which one carries what. And that will help them figure out which ones then to return to the woman's womb to gestate and have that child. This has become very, very helpful technology because about 40 years ago, genetic screening became a major thing, especially in the Jewish community. Tay-Sachs was very, very common amongst Jews. That's an Ashkenazi genetic illness, which is very devastating. A child who has Tay-Sachs will die within 3 or 4 years, without a lot of suffering and a horrible existence. And many people were having children who were dying because of Tay-Sachs, and they wanted to prevent this. So they engaged in a process of genetic screening where people, before they got married, in fact, before they got engaged, would go through genetic screening to determine if they are both carriers for Tay-Sachs. If so, they wouldn't get married. They started asking the rabbis, is this genetic screening allowed? And the rabbi's answer was, why close our eyes to something that, you know, is right there? It's like walking into the middle of the highway blindfolded. Why not check? If we can check, we should check. The thing is, it's not always so simple. First of all, I gave the example of a couple who is not even engaged. Maybe they didn't even meet yet. In some communities, they do genetic screening before they even meet. So that's very simple. But what if a couple is already very much in love? Or what if it's not Tay-Sachs? Tay-Sachs is an easier decision because it's such a horrible illness. People often want to get married if they know they're going to have children with Tay-Sachs. But what if it's not something quite as severe? I'll give an example, because I'm going to talk about it in a minute, of BRCA, the BRCA gene, which leads to breast and ovarian cancer. Often, not always, but 80% of people who carry it will have that. So, and that's also later in life, in one's 30s, let's say. Is that a reason not to get married if a couple knows that they are both, that they're carriers for Bracha? This leads to very complicated questions. And a lot of times, you know, people ask rabbis, genetic counselors, family, you know, what should we do? So for many years, the options were either don't get married, get married, but don't have children, get married, get pregnant, do testing while pregnant, have an abortion if one is able to find out in utero what the fetus is a carrier for, or risk it. Have the children and hope that they'll be okay. Then PGD came along, and PGD added a whole new layer to this, because people could say, you know what, we're going to get married, and then we'll just, every time we want to get pregnant, we'll be able to go through the IVF process, and in the lab, they can determine which fetus, which fertilized embryo is a carrier. So this became a big question for rabbis. Is this allowed? Why for rabbis, by the way? Just a side point, I spent a summer a few years ago at Shari Tzedek Medical Center, kind of doing an internship, seeing how they function, and their fertility lab has a rabbi on staff. And every question, every case, the rabbi has to approve it. It's fascinating. And this became a major question. So the rabbis were being asked, is PGD allowed by Judaism? And the reason why it was a question was because I gave the example of, you know, Tay-Sachs, illnesses. What if someone wants to have PGD for other reasons? What if they say, you know, it's really important to us that my children be blonde. It's really important to me that my children have blue eyes or dark hair or brown eyes or whatever it is. It's really important that my children be tall. You know, like the Ball family, Lonzo Ball, like Ball married potentially a tall woman because he wanted to breed his children to be basketball players. And they're in the NBA now. But I'm saying, what if someone says, you know, I want my children to be basketball players, so I want them to use PGD to make sure I have tall children. Is that appropriate? Like, how far do we go with it? When I was at Shari Tzedek, we had a question. There was a couple who came in. They had five boys. And the husband wanted another child. The wife said, I can't handle any more of these boys. If I knew we were going to have a girl, this is what she said, I would be okay with it. I'll have another child. But for another boy, I can't. I can't. These boys, my boys are driving me crazy. You know, so they went to this clinic and said, if you can guarantee us a girl, we want to have another child. So it goes to the rabbi there. And the rabbi said, I have to ask, you know, they were a Sephardic couple. He asked Rabbi Avadya Yosef, who was the previous chief rabbi of Israel. And I was there when this happened. I remember it. And Rabbi Avadya Yosef, the word came back that he said, permissible. It's allowed. So they did it. But what? How do we decide? So the rabbis at that time, with their PGD, their ruling was, if it's for a medical reason, it should be allowed. If it's for a therapeutic, if it's for a cosmetic reason, it should not be allowed. That was kind of the rule that came up, the guiding principle. For medicine, we allow these kinds of interventions. What's medical, by the way, as you can see from that last case, can be, you know, can be a broad definition. It can include, obviously, mental health. But as long as you have a medically justifiable reason, it could be done. But if it's only therapeutic, purely therapeutic, you know, it's just for, you know, oh, I think it'll be, I want my children all to have, you know, the same hair color, and that's harder to justify for any kind of medical reason. So then the rabbis wanted us to kind of be careful about it. So that was PGD. The other question, by the way, that the rabbis asked about this was, is it abortion? Is it abortion? Why was this a question? As you know, I'm sure this is a, you know, hot topic lately. Judaism is a very you know, open stance towards abortion. It's allowed in very, very many cases. But they were concerned because what do you do with all the embryos, the pre-embryos that are not used? They're discarded or used for research. Was the rabbis discussed? Is this a problem? Is that some kind of, you know, is it a problem to discard these pre-embryos? And they fell on an interesting precedent, fascinating precedent. Here was the case. B'nai Brak, the ultra-Orthodox city in Israel near Tel Aviv. One Shabbat, there was a power outage. There was a fertility clinic there full of frozen embryos. Someone comes running to the rabbi's house. Rabbi, may we turn on the generator, which has a flame? So they were concerned, is this going to violate Shabbat to turn on the generator to save the embryos? What would most of you say? Can you violate Shabbat to save these fertilized eggs, to save, saving potential life? Me too. When I heard this, I thought, it's a simple question. Of course he said yes. He said no. But why do you say no? It was fascinating. First of all, he said, you find someone who's not Jewish to turn it on, found a way to have it done. But he said, if I say yes, you can violate Shabbat, then I'm giving these the status of a human being. And in Judaism, we don't say that a fetus has the status of a human being. He said, if I would have said that, then all of these technologies, all this research, all these things that they were doing, I might have thrown them into question. I might have led people to think, maybe that's problematic. So in order to allow us to experiment and use PGD, for example, he had to say that violating Shabbat to save these pre-embryos was problematic. Just a fascinating way of thinking that because the Torah says, just so you understand, the basis was, the Torah says, Hashofech dam ba'adam, ba'adam damo yishafech. One who sheds the blood of another person, a person may shed their blood. That was the biblical justification for capital punishment. The rabbis then limited it severely, but the Bible itself says capital one. But the rabbi said, wait a second, does that really say a person who sheds a person's blood, a person may shed their blood? What's hashofech dam ba'adam? What's a person within a person? So they said, oh, that must mean a fetus. But he said, wait a second, that's the fetus in the womb. These aren't even in the womb. So they have no status whatsoever, and therefore there's much more room for leniency. That was the thinking. But this led to a precedent. Where am I going with this, and why is this relevant? This leads to another case, which then will lead us back to another fascinating, I think the most fascinating new technology that is literally going to change medicine. And it's happening already. And people don't know about it yet, but you're going to start hearing about it. One other case I'll share with you. Also surprising. It surprised me. Kind of like this fertility clinic case. When someone is a carrier for with BRCA, especially a woman, for men there is high risk of prostate cancer with BRCA diagnosis. But for a woman, and this is like the Angelina Jolie case, right? There's a higher risk of breast and ovarian cancer. Ovarian cancer can be especially deadly because it's harder to detect and it's harder to treat. So what can we do about it? Obviously, people can check frequently. There's also prophylactic surgeries, preventative surgeries. So there, one can have a bilateral mastectomy to remove the risk of breast cancer, and one can have an oophorectomy. An oophorectomy is removing one's ovaries to prevent the risk of ovarian cancer. So the question always is, though, first of all, when to do it, and if one should do it, because we don't always know when someone's going to develop this cancer or if they'll develop the cancer. And obviously, once someone has an oophorectomy, they cannot have children. It causes early onset menopause, and their ovaries are removed. So often people will want to have children first before they have this procedure that prevents the chances of them having ovarian cancer. This leads to horrible dilemmas because people first of all don't want to find out because it's very scary to find out what they're a carrier for. And for many, many years, many doctors were saying, you know, what's the point? Why find out? There's not much we can do about it, so it's just going to scare you. You just do regular screenings, and if you find out that your person is a carrier, has it, we'll treat it. But finding out ahead of time, what's the point? Then they started to realize, well, you know, we can now do things about it. So this surgery can obviously save lives. Now, people ask, you know, I remember a question I was asked once when this first happened, when this was a new thing 15 years ago. A member of my synagogue said to me, and this is an Orthodox synagogue, she said to me, Rabbi, I'm embarrassed to ask you this, but this is just a reality. I found out, I did this testing, my aunt died from ovarian cancer. So the doctor said everyone's family should get tested. I was tested and I found out that I'm a carrier. I'm 31 years old. She died at 35. And my grandfather died at 35. So I need to do something about this. But I really want to have children first. Here's the problem. My boyfriend is not Jewish. So she asked me, Rabbi, what do I do? I want to marry him because I want to have children. I mean, Rabbi, are you really going to tell me that I can't do that? When, look at my options now. And I felt for her. I mean, it was a really hard question to me. I got her question. She on the one hand, she wanted to marry a Jewish man, but she also, this is her life could be at risk. And if she breaks up with him, it might take her time to find another man. I suggested freezing her eggs. But she wasn't comfortable with that. She did marry him. But these are the types of questions that people have. So in fact, someone asked me once, at that same time, someone asked me, does Jewish law allow this procedure? So I sent them to a rabbi. At that time, I hadn't developed an expertise in this topic. So I sent them to a rabbi, It was a mistake who I sent them to in the end, in retrospect. He said, no, the surgery is not allowed by Jewish law. I thought, how could that be? He said, she currently doesn't have cancer. She has might have genes, but she doesn't have an illness. So how can I justify her doing this when she's currently not sick? That was his answer. I was really disturbed by that. So I said, this needs more study. So I brought it to some of the greatest leading rabbis in Israel. And I did a lot of research first. I brought him some studies to show the likelihood that the genes, someone has the genes, will lead to illness, and how effective the surgeries can be in preventing the cancer. So these rabbis gave a fascinating ruling. In fact, then I published it, I tried to spread a word. Actually, it's in the book, and we got it published in Israel in Hebrew, and I've been sharing this with people because I think it's so important, it can save lives. They made the following argument. In Jewish law, you can't kill, right? Thou shalt kill. Well, it says thou shalt murder. Can't murder someone, right? However, there is one exception. An exception is, what if someone is chasing a person to kill them? It's called a rodef. Someone's chasing you, and there's no other way to save yourself. Of course, if there's another way, you shouldn't kill people. But if there's the only way to save one's life in self-defense is to kill the person chasing the person to save, it's allowed. It's called a rodef in Jewish law. A chaser. A rodef. I thought this was brilliant. The rabbi said to me, now that we know that the reality that genes have, that genetics play, we can see the genes as the rodef. Our genes are the rodef. So even if someone comes to a rabbi, comes to a doctor, comes to a geneticist, a genetic counselor, and says, you know, I have this, I'm a carrier for this genetic mutation, even though I'm not sick right now, is it enough to act upon it? So the rabbis are now saying, yeah, the gene itself carries a status. The gene gives us enough. So that gives another layer to what people can do about this illness. But now I want to share with you a new wrinkle in what technology is bringing us. And then I'll start to bring it all together, everything. And you'll see why I shared all these things. It might have seemed random, what I was sharing. This is a very new technology. Just happened 4 months ago. There's a researcher at Cedars-Sinai. Actually, I'll mention his name. It's Clive Svensson. Clive Svensson, just to share with you the kind of research that's happening. I'm very Cedars-Sinai-centric. I apologize. It's only because I've been there for 15 years. I just don't know the other hospitals. But I'm sure this is happening around the country, amazing things. But I just am privy to some of these things that are just mind-boggling. In his lab, they do stem cell research. It's a stem cell research lab. Now, stem cell research is transforming medicine. The amazing things one can do. Imagine someone, one thing they can do, for example, when someone has a heart attack, and part of their heart as a result becomes, is not functioning anymore. So using stem cells, they can that kind of regenerate the heart to make it new again, to make it function perfectly again. That's the type of thing stem cell research does. In his lab, you know, stem cell research in the Catholic Church, it's considered abortion because you're using embryonic stem cells. And like I said before, Judaism does not see it that way. But the problem is, what the Catholic Church says, for better or for worse, matters because federal funding is often tied to politics. And depending on who, and I promise this, I'm not making political statements here, this is just the reality. Depending on who's president at a given time depends on what the government will fund. Now, embryonic stem cell research, you know, you can take embryos. So the technology, just to understand, when before a baby, a fetus becomes a baby, it's a blastocyst, right? It starts as two cells, then four cells, then eight cells, then 16 cells. At a certain point, it begins to differentiate, and then all of a sudden, you can start to see a head and hands and feet. But at first, it's just a bunch of cells. And each cell is what we call pluripotent. Each cell can become anything. So it's amazing what we can do with science. You can take a pluripotent cell and you can do anything you want. You could create a new kidney for someone out of it and not need kidney transplants. Speaking of, you know, using pigs, one day we'll be able to use that to just create our own new hearts from embryonic stem cells. But if you see embryonic stem cell research as abortion and then the government doesn't allow it, so that cuts off this whole line of interesting research. So in his lab, what they did was they figured out how to take adult stem cells, like just from our skin, from a cheek swab, adult cells that are already skin cells, you know, and rewind them so that they become pluripotent again. So they said, we don't need them to be embryonic. We can take adult, they call these adult-induced pluripotent stem cells, IPSD, something like that. And so they figured out in their lab how to rewind our cells and then fast-forward them back. Now, once they figured that out, listen to this. One of their researchers in their lab, just during the pandemic, was just, you know, kind of playing around in their lab. This news will get out soon. I posted it on my Facebook page. You know, it's starting to come out. But it was interesting to me because as a Jew, and being that BRCA is a Jewish, it's an Ashkenazi Jewish genetic mutation. So she was just interested. What can we do with people's genetics now that we can play with their cells and fast forward them? We now have this technology to fast forward ourselves, rewind ourselves. She created in the lab a fallopian tube. She showed me. I put a picture of it on my Facebook, actually. I mean, you can't really see. I don't know what I'm looking at when I look at it. I have no idea what I was looking at, but it was some kind of a mass of cells, and or so she told me. And she then can fast forward a person's cells and say, okay, let me take them to be, you know, one day old, and now I'll just fast forward them through their life in our lab, and I'll see how their cells develop. So she was able to say, let's take this person with BRCA. And now I'll fast forward their cells, and I'll see, first of all, if they develop cancer. If so, at what age they develop cancer. If so, which type of cancer. And not only that, I'll see what will be the best treatment for that cancer. Meaning, will chemotherapy be good? If so, which chemotherapy will it respond to? Which will not respond to? Will it need surgery? Will it not need surgery? And I can just fast forward in the lab and I'll know. So for example, this questioner in my synagogue who asked me at age 31, you know, Rabbi, should I just get married now because I think I only have 4 years based on my parents, that she could go to this doctor and they will take her cells and say, well, we can actually tell you exactly what, if you will develop this cancer and at exactly what age you will develop the cancer. It's incredible. So that this is what we call precision medicine. It's literally taking an individual, taking their cells and determining what's going to happen to them in their lives. Now, obviously, not everything's genetic. First of all, there's epigenetics. We know that our genes are influenced by sometimes lifestyle and our surroundings, and sometimes it could be wrong. There's some things that are not genetic at all, right? Let's say smoking leads to cancer, things like that. There's things that we can do that can cause illnesses, but there are many of things that are genetic. And so this would add a whole new layer to our options, right? We could just say, well, why not just go to one of these precision medicine specialists, and they can help us determine if it's what will happen in our lives, which would totally change medicine. Now, before I get to like the real punchline, because that's not even it, there's one more step with that. My first question was, what is this? Is there any problem with this Jewishly? Is there anything wrong with this? Or is this totally good? It kind of sounds great. I mean, we could go to our doctor and just know everything that's going to happen to us and when it's going to happen, and we can then act based on that. It sounds amazing. And I think it is amazing. I think it really is. Here's my concern, my only concern. It's not a major concern. Let's go back to Chizkiyahu, the great King Chizkiyahu. There was another thing that he did in his life. It's a strange thing that he did. But the Talmud says that there was a book of healing, Sefer Refuot, that they had in the times of the temple, the Beit HaMikdash in Jerusalem. Sefer Refuot, they had a book that had all the herbs and plants that one could use for healing and which illness would be treated by which herb. And it taught, and it was this book of healing. And actually, just a side point, I said I wouldn't be too Cedar Sinai centric, but one of the major, we know from the Talmud, one of the major plants that they used was cedar trees. That's why you have Cedars of Lebanon was a hospital, because cedar trees were believed to be a healing tree. Anyways, you know what he did though, Chizkiyahu? He realized everyone was going to the book for healing, and they believed that they had all the power in the book. They didn't rely on God. They had no humility. They could just do whatever they want in life. They'll get sick. Big deal. We have the book that teaches us how to cure every disease. So Chizkiyahu took the book and banished it, hid it away. And the rabbis, the Talmud says, were proud of him for it. They said he did the right thing. To me, it's like crazy. What do you mean? Why would you get rid of a medical textbook? You'd save lives. But it's just an interesting idea, like, how we have to also make sure, like, that we don't get too haughty about things. We don't lose our reliance on God. So that's the challenge for us in the coming years. But there's another step. I asked Clive Svendsen, and by the way, if you follow his lab at all, he just sent a rocket ship into space, like 2 weeks ago, literally. Cedar-Sinai sent a rocket ship into space because they're trying to see if this research works even better in zero gravity. They have reason to believe it'll happen even faster and smoother in zero gravity. So they sent a rocket ship, and they have a lab in space where they're doing this research now. So I said to him, what's next after outer space? What's next? Like, okay, so now you can tell patients their medical, not just their history, but their medical future. He said, next, CRISPR. This brings us back to CRISPR. Why CRISPR? Well, now what I just told you is a person can take, you know, give their swab and see their genes, and their doctor can tell them, okay, you will develop this or that illness at that age, and here's what we can do about it. What if we could just, instead of saying what we should do about it, what if the doctor could just say, this is what he said to me, let's just cut that gene out of your DNA. Let's just remove it. Why should you have to develop this illness when you turn 35 or whatever the age is, 95? Let's just cut it out. Let's just remove it. And that's where they're going. That's where it's moving. So this will be the big question. Now, it's scary for the reasons I mentioned at the beginning, because what are the off-target effects? Is anyone saying to slow down? I just read a great book called The Precipice. I forgot the name of the author. It's not a Jewish book, but it's interesting. And it's about the major concerns that are threats to human survival in the coming years. The major concerns are, you know, nuclear war and pandemics and global warming and artificial intelligence. And he argues, and I'm going to conclude with this with one more example of it, he argues artificial intelligence is the biggest threat to human survival. Why? Okay, I'll talk about that in 1 second and then I'll conclude. But he says, in his opinion, human civilization, we know from history, has been around for a few thousand years, thousands of years, right? In the thousands. Not much more than 6,000-8,000 years. I'm not talking about humans as a species, but as modern civilization. He says he thinks, you know, based on other species, we could have 100 million to a billion more years. If you think about that, we're only a few thousand years old now as a species, as humanity. But we could live 100 million, a billion years. If we think that we are advanced now, imagine what humanity will be like. You know, we think, oh, anyone get the iPhone 14 yet? Well, they're going to laugh at the iPhone 14 in a billion years. I mean, imagine what the technology will be then. Remember the olden days, those iPhones, you had to hold it. You know, they're going to make fun of their technology. So he says, so we are like adolescents in human history, right? We're at the adolescent stage of humanity, of the development of being a human. So he says, what's the problem with adolescence? Adolescence is the stage in life. You know, when you start to become like, let's say, a pre-teenager, a teenager, it's when we start to develop enough physical strength, enough physical maturity to do things that could get us into a lot of trouble, that could cause a lot of harm, that we don't yet have the maturity to, you know, recognize yet. And we can make mistakes. Why is that okay in human beings? Because we have parents to stop us. We have society to teach us. But then the question becomes, well, what about humanity? If as humanity, we are like preteens right now, we're developing incredible capabilities. We could do a lot of stuff, and we're getting really close to controlling the human genome. But yet, who's there to tell us, wait, be mature about this, be careful. You know, I have learned from my mistakes. I don't want you to learn from what I've went through, like our parents tell us, right? Or we tell our children, our grandchildren. Who is there? Who are our parents to tell us? And I think in many ways, that's what the Jewish community is called on to be for humanity. Or I think there's ethicists, there needs to be people, whoever they are, you know, community leaders, it could be politicians, whatever someone thinks. I think rabbi, I'm biased, but I think it's a rabbi's job to be sounding out the alarm. You know, on the one hand, we as I said, Rabbi Akiva said, we do play God. We do want to help humanity. We do till the soil. We do develop, we take wheat and turn it into bread. But also, at the same time, Hanikashi derachmana lamalach. There's somewhere a limit where we're not playing God. And this came about, and this will be my last example of new things that happened in the last 2 years. During the pandemic, there were times when we had very scary triage decisions to make. Last January, not this year, previous January, at our hospital, I know many hospitals like this, Cedars-Sinai became overwhelmed, completely overwhelmed with COVID patients. And we were trying to figure out, what are we going to do if we run out of ventilators, if we run out of ICU space? And we already had all of our operating rooms had to be turned into ICUs. And we had to come up with an algorithm to determine who will get the ventilators, because we were scared we wouldn't have enough ventilators for all the patients that needed them. So we developed Cedars-Sinai, along with a number of leading hospitals around the country, all the big names, you know, Mass General and, Hopkins and all the big, great hospitals in the country. We had made a consortium, and we developed scores called SOFA scores, sequential organ failure assessments. And we could take a patient's charts and develop a score for every patient. And based on their score determines if they get a ventilator. Those with the highest likelihood of survival get the ventilator. Those who have less likelihood of survival don't get a ventilator. And it became a mathematical equation, and artificial intelligence could help determine and learn who will get the ventilator. We developed it as practice. As practice, we began scoring patients. Thank God, as we got totally full and overwhelmed, the numbers started going down, and we didn't have to ration any ventilators, thank God. But we continued to score patients because we wanted to see if we were right. Let's just see, did we get it right? Let's watch the trajectory. We watched them for a year, and we did not get it right. We were not right. The artificial intelligence ended up trying to figure out who would survive, and it was not right. Not only, embarrassingly, but I'll share this because it's important. Not only was it, the SOFA score did not determine who had the better chance of survival. For some reason that we're not sure of yet, people of color were more likely to score worse and therefore not get the ventilator. And we don't know why. We're not sure yet why. There's some theories. But so not only did this scoring not work, it turned out to be racist, basically, which is shocking and horrible, right? And it's like, wait a second. We were relying on this data, these mathematical equations, and the computers to help us with artificial intelligence, and we're not there yet. It didn't work. Thank God, like I said, it was never used on a patient. We didn't get there. It was what we were going to use, but we didn't. But to me, it's just a reminder. We're getting so far technologically. We can do so much. We can accomplish so much. But there's risks to it. And on the one hand, it's amazing. And I bless our scientists, our researchers. They should continue researching and discovering, because this is God's work. Verapo yirapeh, the Torah tells us. We believe in healing. We believe in medicine. Judaism believes in technology, in sophistication, in advancement. But we believe in being responsible also, and being careful, and doing what's in the best interest of humanity. And sometimes just because you can do something doesn't mean that you should do something. And it gets very exciting when we start discovering, wow, look what we can do. Look how we can manipulate the human genome. It's incredible. We can really do amazing things one day. And we're really almost getting there. But we're going to have to go there carefully. And some people are going to have to ask these questions, like, is this the best idea? And so my blessing for all of us, and the challenge is going to be, you know, in the coming years, to live in a world where, you know, this book, by the way, that I mentioned, The Precipice, he's very optimistic. Even though I mentioned all those horrible things, pandemics, he's optimistic. He says, you know what, humanity, we have a lot of ingenuity. There's a lot of things we can accomplish. As long as we can do it with maturity, with wisdom, with caution, we can survive. We can do great things. And I believe that our tradition has a lot to teach us about it. We have guidance. There are sources in our ancient tradition that can give us guidance. And so may God bless us with the wisdom to use these traditions, to use these sources correctly, to be able to move forward carefully. And may we move forward. May the memory of those who came before us be a blessing. People like Laser Cohen, who inspired us to always ask questions, ask on the intersection of both God and science and medicine, and find out, you know, how can we use that book of healing such that we don't need to banish it again, because we can actually move forward in a responsible way. And I believe that we have that capability. And with God's help, we'll all get there in good health for many years. And may God bless all of us and all of you here today. Again, may Laser Cohen's memory be a blessing. And shalom to all of you. We look forward to sharing in beautiful occasions and in good health.